Rory will never be wrong because what he is proposing will never happen. What is your response to that critique about you?
Very, very impressive, I have to say.
This is Take Two.
You quoted David Attenborough on page 266. Is this how our story is due to end? A tale of the smartest species, doomed by that all too human characteristic of failing to see the bigger picture in pursuit of short-term goals. Now, you always talk about the importance of talking about the home. Let's talk about the home. What does the home mean to you, Rory?
So the home means to me, and it's very interesting, you started with the quote from David Attenborough, because the home, in a sense, is our planet, is the home, is our home. It's our collective home. And our home is a place that we can feel safe, ideally. It is somewhere that gives us protection from the weather, and that's particularly important in countries like Ireland, where it's not great a lot of the time. And it is a place that we can feel a sense of belonging, a sense of connection. It's somewhere that's stable. And these are what I write about in the book, the what are called, I suppose, from a psychological perspective, the they're called the psychosocial kind of functions of home. And essentially, we think a lot about housing, and a lot of people talk about property and property values and, you know, real estate and, you know, rents and house prices and units, but they don't talk about home and what purpose home serves for us as human beings. And I really kind of talked about that in the book, because I think that there's something we miss, which is that home isn't just a place where we go to, you know, that it's something much more deeply meaningful to us, and not just meaningful in the sense of this place matters to me, but it actually has a deep psychological role for us in terms of us as human beings, how we develop from being children to being adults. And of course, you can see that across the board in terms of, you know, a lot of young people now who can't afford to move out of home, they're stuck living with parents until their 20s, even into 30s, and how they feel they can't be a full adult until they have their own place. And then, of course, we have in Ireland renters who are living in a state of more or less constant anxiety about will the landlord turf them out or not, or is it going to be sold? And so I think kind of what I tried to talk about what home means is during the Celtic Tiger, which was the mid to late 1990s until the 2007-08, there was this whole boom, housing boom, and lots of people in Ireland bought housing and were lent a lot of money to do so. But people bought multiple housing and property, and people just thought about they didn't think about their home. They thought about this place, this building they had, and how much was it worth? What was the property value? Was it worth 200,000, 300, 500,000? They watch it grow each year and they go, this is great. Look at my property is worth. And then they might buy multiple properties and they become landlords and they look at it as an investment. And I suppose what I really trying to see is that, you know, home is not those things. Home is not investment in that sense. Home needs to be a place that's secure, that people can feel safe, as I said, that they can feel stable, they can have their life, they can do the things they need to do. And I feel that we've lost that in Ireland.
Are you starting to see a little bit of a shift in, rather than looking at a house to a home now, like, what's your perspective on that right now? Is there a greater demand, dare I say, on, no, I want a home. I want to hang up a picture. I want to have a pet. I want to have a dog. Like, I want to get rid of this ugly sofa and bring in a new one. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I think there is. I absolutely do. And I think, you know, amongst the younger generations, or, you know, however we want to define youth. But people in their 20s and 30s, I think, you know, and of course there are people in their 40s and 50s as well who are still renting. And in the private rental sector, that is not in social housing, but renting from landlords where they're paying very high rents and don't have that security for different reasons. You know, we have seen a huge increase in the amount of people who are renting from landlords and renting for longer. And in that context, then people, you're absolutely right. People are looking at it and going, you know, it's not just a case that I'm here for a few years. I could be living here for my entire life. So I have to see it as my home. And what does that mean? And I think there is a real demand from people for housing and property to be treated as a home.
Yeah.
And I think particularly I see a big clash of kind of values going on between an older generation who own multiple properties.
Yeah.
The landlords that are referred to, that they're, you know, they are landlords, and saying, this is my property. I can do whatever I want with it, and I should be able to do whatever I want with it. And it's one of the big things that I really get hammered on social media by the, you know, lots of normal people who say, you know, I'm a landlord. I just own one property, or I just own two properties, like additional to their home, and going, you know, this, you know, I'm constantly bashing landlords, they say to me. And I'm like, I'm not bashing landlords. I'm just saying you can't look at somewhere that, you know, someone is living as a tenant as just your property investment.
Yeah. Like, I think that's it. It's as if a lot of them are looking at the investment. Look, if you worked hard for it and like you got a property, like props to you, like pat on the back, well done. But in saying that, it's also like, I think they're viewing it as a hotel, you know? It's like if someone is living there, allowing them to like literally make themselves feel a little bit at home, make themselves feel a little less scared of your car pulling up in front of the house. Mm. That's basically it. It's like, I wouldn't say it's a European thing, but it is like, it is over here. It is back home for us as well, where it is like, no, this is, it's still my place. Like, stay in your place. That's mine.
Mm.
You know, and we're constantly reminded about that, if that makes sense.
It does completely. And I did rent for the first 10 years of my life. I rented and then I rented again from, you know, up till I was 30 during the, you know, when I rented. And I remember that, you know, when you're there and the landlord, you know, you're constantly in a sense of fear of the landlord and, you know, what are they going to say? And, you know, what can you do? And you want to make sure, you know, you don't ask them to fix something. And I know it's got even, you know, so much worse since I was renting. And I hear that all the time, and tenants, you know, renters contact me all the time saying, you know, we live in this situation, we're just terrified. And even now, for example, the discussion about the tax credit that renters have a right to get and have been, you know, given by the government rightfully. But some renters are afraid to even ask their landlord for the landlord details. Now, you can still apply for it, but they're still worried, like, will the landlord kick me out because I've ratted them out to revenue? And this power dynamic is so deeply unhealthy. And it's unusual in the sense of, you know, for many European countries like Germany, Denmark, Sweden, this isn't how, you know, tenants live. They live like in complete sense of, once I'm paying the rent and not bashing the place or like trashing the place.
Yeah.
Well, I can be here. It's my home.
Exactly. And literally on the point of that, you mentioned when I was discussing this with you before, but you pointed out the house prices and what happened between 2020 and 2021. And you said that in response to the COVID pandemic crisis, I'm basically reading your work back to you.
This is a, you've certainly done your research.
This is a lecture for me. Like I'm in my student days now. In response to the COVID pandemic crisis, the government did what it said it couldn't do all the way through the last decade of the crisis. It froze rents and put a ban on evictions. The number of evictions in the private rental sector collapsed. Homelessness fell dramatically. Unfortunately, it took a global pandemic to show what was possible to solve the housing crisis. Even more sadly, the measures were just temporary. And as soon as the pandemic receded, so too did the emergency housing policies that had given some relief to those hardest hit by the crisis. Mm. Which is literally what you just said there, is that the government acted when it could.
Mm.
And in 2020, we were looking at a rent in Dublin at €1,783. Flipped the page and it went up by 7.4% within a year.
Yeah.
And that's like the tough thing, eh? And you're constantly talking about putting an eviction ban on right now. And I wanted to ask you this, like, what do you see ideally if eviction bans were to come through? How long would this go on for in an ideal world for you?
Yeah, I think it was incredible to see during COVID what was done around housing in particular. It was interesting the things that changed. For example, Airbnb dried up. You know, people obviously weren't using Airbnb. And we know that quite a number of Airbnb properties were then rented out for maybe 6 months or a year basis and actually played a big role in housing people who were homeless. And it also showed, you know, and it hasn't been talked about much after, is how much Airbnb is actually eating up in terms of real homes, real rental homes. And
is it eating it up a lot right now?
It is. They're in the region of exact figure, like they're saying that you could probably, there's between 12,000 to 16,000 full properties listed all the time.
What do you mean by full property?
So this is a complete apartment or house that's listed to be available for on Airbnb all the time. So it's not that it's just like somebody's holiday room or they're gone on holiday for 2 weeks. And also thousands are listed by multiple property owners. Or sorry, by an owner who has multiple of these listings on Airbnb. So this is not somebody's home. Or even, you know, this is multiple, this is landlords essentially using Airbnb. And of course, I write about this in the book. And before I go back to the question you're asking, because it's something that, you know, I think is very not again talked about enough, is what Airbnb want to do.
Yeah.
Like Airbnb want more and more people to be using Airbnb. That's their company, that's their business model. But what that means is they want more and more people who have long terms, you know, whatever, secure, but at least leases or something, to actually, they want the landlords, the property owners, to use Airbnb. So they and the CEO said it himself. He said, you know, we see the future where tenants don't have a lease, that they live on this sort of, you know, short stay if they want to live. You know, they might like to live in Dublin, you know, for 3 months and then go somewhere else. And then it's this idea and it's like, oh, that is like, it's just horrific to think this is what I call it, is the, you know, the way that we have the gig economy, you know, the way jobs are all turned into short term, precarious, you know.
They're all going to Bali though. They're not moving to fucking Dublin if they want to be a nomad and work. Sorry.
Well, you would be surprised that it's not that people want to go to Dublin.
No.
It's that if the only way they can get somewhere is through Airbnb, then they would be forced to use it.
Yeah, but like with the gig economy, like, let's be honest now. If you got a remote working job and you're based in Germany.
Yeah.
Remotely, and it's a gig economy that we're looking at. Do you want to be on? I love Dublin. I'm a foreigner. I love Dublin. Yeah. I'm here for a reason.
Yeah.
Are you going to go to Dublin for just to be on your laptop? No, you're going to be in a much cheaper place, ideally.
But there's lots of people who, it's not that they ideally want to, let's say, as you say, if their choice is to go to Dublin as their first choice of where they can go to remote work, but they might have to work here, for example, 3 months.
Yes, for sure.
Or their job might be based here and they decide, am I going to be here or not? Or they want to live here as with their job and be here. And if more and more properties are being rented under Airbnb, they won't have a choice but to take up these temporary type. And my point is that Airbnb wants that. So they want more and more. So this is their model of turning longer term rentals into short term rentals.
So they're like having a little bit of an influence on the way of life or the
exactly.
path. That,
yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And they're having a significant influence on the housing market. As I said there, you know, there's multiples of properties listed on Airbnb versus how many are listed on Daft to rent. So it's a real problem. And it's a real problem in Ireland because Ireland is a small country and anywhere is a tourist area. You know, tourists will go anywhere in Ireland. Yeah. And so anywhere is potentially an Airbnb. And I think that's a real issue as well. And we see that. And of course, we don't have regulations as well on that. But back to your question on COVID, what was done then, and what, you know, it showed what was possible. And the eviction ban, we have, when the eviction ban that was introduced during COVID and the rent freeze, they said they had to lift that in March, April 2021, because we have a constitutional protection of the private property. And if they left these measures in too long, they would essentially breach the private property right of landlords. And they lifted them, and myself and others said, okay, if you lift these bans and rent freezes, rents are going to go up, people are going to be evicted, there's going to be much more homelessness. And unfortunately, it's exactly what's happened. We've seen particular homelessness significantly increase, and landlords selling up as well, because property prices have reached, you know, so high, they're gone way above the Celtic Tiger. So these small time landlords who are getting in as an investment are now selling up. And they want to evict the tenants so that they can get the highest price possible for their property. Because of the homelessness being so high and nowhere to rent, the government reintroduced an eviction ban. And that is in place over, they reintroduced it in November. And that is running until the end of March, early April.
That's a short time.
It's a very short time. So I am really worried what's going to happen come April. We know there are literally thousands of tenants, renters who've been served an eviction notice because the land, not because they've done anything wrong, but because the landlord is selling. I think they should extend that eviction ban for at least a year. In reality, probably about 2 to 3 years until this, you know, the housing they say they're supplying is actually going to increase. Because where are renters going to go to?
Mm-hmm. Like you actually spoke about like the supply and demand thing, which I think is a massive thing, because so many people talk about the supply and demand concept that there isn't that much happening right now. We don't have that many places to go. The only places that are available are sky high, crazy rents. No one can keep up with that. And you actually mentioned, let me find it over here. I'm pretty sure it's
I love before. The the post-its. What do you call them? The little things on the side of the page that you've stuck in.
Side. Oh my God.
There's probably a particular name for them.
Yes, yes. There has to be.
Sticky thing on the side of the page.
Sticky bookmark. Shall we call it a sticky bookmark?
Yeah, actually, they're very impressive, I have to say.
Listen, talking about like things going up, I haven't had to buy stationery, like educational, like pens. And I got sticky notes. You know how much these sticky notes were? €6 Because I don't want to get plastic. They are all paper-based and tearing up. There you go.
But it's good though, it's good.
Look, it's easier to
the last person who I saw did that to my book was the President of Ireland. When I met him, he read my last book and he had it similarly, all little sticky notes like that. So yourself and the
call me Michael
President of, exactly.
I don't know if this is a fun fact. When I first moved to Ireland, right, I was in Oranmore in Galway.
Yeah.
And the such a side note, but anyways, it was the first time I ever saw posters for politicians. Mm. It looked so foreign to me, right? And I remember looking.
You don't, where are you from again?
I'm from Malta.
Malta. You don't have posters for politicians?
No. We have social media and billboards and stuff. Different story.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyways, it's like a bunch of posters up against like trees and whatever. And I saw Michael D. Higgins' face. It was for the presidential election.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, he's so cute. And like in my head, I'm like, this poor old man, like he's so cute. Little did I know that he was actually like he was being reelected and all that. I was so happy for him. As if you adorable man.
Yeah.
I was, like, I'd love to meet him.
I would say a lot of people voted for him on that basis. That he's just an adorable, and doesn't just look adorable, he is adorable.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Like you just believe the persona as well. Anyways, back to Michael D. Shaw instead. So you spoke about market supply and demand, which I was really excited about. And you said that there are fundamental problems.
We're very excited about market supply and demand. That's a funny statement.
Yeah, I think it's because I got a little bit of shtick on it because I would have had a housing crisis episode before.
Okay.
And long story short, this was when I was self-recording and I didn't get the video right.
Right.
but I had the audio. So I needed to use like an audio file to promote the episode. And I just took a bunch of videos around all of Dublin and promoted it.
Mm.
It ended up on the right wrong side of social media because we spoke about the supply.
Yeah.
It was a really good clip, in fairness. I think you would agree with it. But everyone roasted like the episode, saying that the reason for supply is that everyone should build up in Dublin and we should have skyscrapers.
Mm.
And at first in the episode, I was a little bit against it because coming from a foreign perspective, I was like, but Dublin is so nice like this, like without the skyscrapers.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then he did explain the reason for the supply, right? And I was like, you know what? I'm no economist. Like I can't argue with that. But then lo and behold, here you are saying that there are fundamental problems with applying the theory of free market economics to housing.
Mm.
And that's why it's highlighted and I got really excited.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes complete sense.
There you go. That's why I was excited.
Yeah.
But would you mind explaining the market supply and demand concept and what these problems are?
Okay, so the general kind of idea that everyone has about kind of economics and the free market is that if there is something people want, let's say, you know, you could talk about cars or bananas or TVs, or they say, okay, if you don't have a lot of it, let's say, and it's something people want, then the price will go up because people can charge more for it and people want it. So they will, you know, pay more for it because it's a scarce thing. And then the idea is that, well, housing would work sort of similar, that if, you know, prices are high because there isn't a lot of it, there isn't a lot of supply. So if you provide lots more supply, prices will fall. That's the kind of theory.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of problems with that because housing is apartments, housing development is complex to build and develop. It's not like just producing a TV, or I'm constantly banging the mic, a TV or something like that. It takes a lot of time to develop. And there's a lot, like, so you need to get land, you need to put in like the basic stuff of, you know, water pipes, waste pipes, you need to get planning permission, you need to get money, the finance, and this, you're not talking about like even for your own house, but for developing, let's say, 100 homes or 200, it takes a lot of money. And the different people who control the land, all different people control the money, which is the banks, people who own land are landowners. And they all make different decisions about whether to sell their land or not. And so I kind of think land is a really good example, because you look around Dublin and you can see now there's lots of sites there.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think, wow, land it is really expensive because there's not a lot of it. And, you know, house prices and rents are really high. So you would think, wow, if you owned land right now, surely you'd be selling it because you'd make a huge amount of money. But that's not the way they work, because they're all individual landowners who decide, maybe I want to sell now, maybe I don't. And the system doesn't work like what the economists call a perfect market. There's a whole load of aspects to it that are irrational. People don't make logical decisions, but all the pieces in housing, the land, the finance, the planning, all have to work together in order for the homes to be produced. And even if the homes are produced, like, for example, the build to rent is an example, the investor fund build to rent, people argue really strongly, that's going to, you know, they say this is the supply we need and it'll bring down rents. Is there? But then you go, well, what price are they renting at? And because they have this expectation of huge profits, they're charging rents which are literally like probably some of the most expensive in the world. Embarrassing, actually illogical, like $3,500 for a two-bedroom apartment, not at like, you know, I don't know, 300 square meter penthouse in the top of some spot in Madison Square Gardens in New York. But like, this is Dublin, like, you know, this is dirty old Dublin charging $3,500, just madness.
Oh, but you got your local spa.
You do have your local spa, absolutely. And you have the Liffey, and you have the wonderful Dublin Bay to swim in once
you've
rinsed yourself in Milton afterwards. And You know, no, it's a great place. Absolutely, yeah, it is. And we have the lovely Dublin Mountains and it's a great community. But $3,500, come on. That's just, you know, funny money. And so this was the supply. This is the supply that the market's providing. So clearly, it's generally accepted that from anyone who's logical as an economist understands that the housing market doesn't work like a normal free market because of these reasons. And also a big issue is that in markets, let's say you're selling a car, right? And it's a fancy car, a new Tesla or whatever. I don't know how much a Tesla is.
Around like 35 grand.
I'd say probably more than that.
Maybe more than that.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway.
Maybe 50.
Maybe 50. Or a BMW, a new electric BMW or something. Yeah, it's probably 100 grand or something. You produce that car and you go, well, if I sell it, you know, I know I'll sell a certain amount. But you can let it sit there. And if people can't afford to buy it, it sits there. Maybe you produce a bit less next year. But with a home, there's lots of people, if they can't afford to buy the BMW, they don't have a home. So it's like we shouldn't apply those rules that, you know, people produce something on the basis that they'll make money from selling it. But there's lots of people who can't, what is referred to as create a demand, as in they don't have the finances to pay enough so that a producer goes, I'll make it because I'll make money selling to you.
Yeah.
So that's where we're seeing, that's again an example, the market, the free market doesn't work in housing.
Because you're saying that these people that can't afford a mortgage right now aren't classified as demand.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's it.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So you have, you know, people who, let's say they can get a mortgage of 200,000, mm-hmm. but a builder says, well, I can only build a home for 400,000. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I'm not going to build for you.
Yeah, you're out.
Exactly. You're out. And what's happening now in Ireland is that actually builders are saying, we're not building at all. We're stopping building. I don't know if you've heard this.
No, I haven't.
There has been a fall in the number of new homes being started. So government will say figures for this year, last year, 2022, we're going to build around 28,000, between 24,000 to 28,000 new units. It's the most we've built in years. It's great. Supply is up. But what's happened is over the last 3 months, the new starts of homes has fallen.
And what's the reason for that?
The reason is the rise in cost of materials with inflation since the war in Ukraine, but even before that. That's one of the big reasons. And the other big reason is interest rates are rising. So it means it's more expensive to get finance and it's also harder for people to get a mortgage. And they're worried about whether they'll be able to sell mm-hmm. or not. And prices, they say now prices aren't even high enough to justify them being able to build and sell. And also then, investor funds now are less interested in Ireland because they are finding it is a good thing.
Yeah,
it is a good thing. But the problem is that the government was dependent on them to provide this new supply. Mm-hmm. So it shows the market doesn't really work mm-hmm. in housing. And lots of people will argue that, oh, we need this really high rise, big, massive, you know, developments of apartment blocks that, you know, that will be a great supply. And, you know, the investor funds would do that. And that was the argument all along. But they don't, you know, these big developments that charge really high rents, there's nowhere where they actually bring down rents or, you know, provide affordable housing. So I think that the problem has been that, the free market doesn't work to provide affordable housing.
Yeah. Affordable housing and social housing. You mentioned government policy as well. And this I'm actually really excited about. Because you said that government policy for the last 10 years has been trying to increase house prices and rents, making housing unaffordable to you, the reader, in order to make it more profitable for vulture funds, corporate landlords, the banks and private developers. Now, when reading this, I asked you, how is that and why?
Yeah. Yeah, no, well found. That was, I think something that it was actually writing an article for the journal.ie that I kind of first said that really starkly. And I was writing for them and it was with the editor, Laura Byrne. And she was the Voices editor, and she was saying to me, you know, are you saying that they don't actually want people to have an affordable home? She said, because that's like really, really...
That's ballsy, yeah.
It's yeah, exactly. It's stark, and it's quite a statement to make. And I said, yeah, like, it is essentially. That is the result of their policy. And on the one hand, they go, oh, but you're, you know, the... Whoever it was at the time, the Minister for Housing then was probably Owen Murphy, and at the time it might have been, and or Simon Coveney, who's was the Housing Minister. You know, the Taoiseach was Leo Varadkar at the time. Like, they don't really want house prices to rise, but actually they did. And the reason why was because, in a way, the exact same thing that I've just said, developers and investor funds were telling them, we can't build if prices don't rise, because it's not viable for us. And similarly with rents, that if the rents didn't keep rising, investor funds wouldn't be interested in coming in here. So, and I go through the book and I show this in detail, that there was a number of times when opposition political parties proposed to the government to freeze rents, control them. And the government said, no, no, we don't want to do that, because if we do that, that will, what they said, deter investors, which will mean we won't get the supply that will at some point bring down rents.
Crazy.
So it was like they bought into, they believe in the market themselves. That's essentially it. And they didn't have, you know, that skepticism of the market that I would hold. And I would think that analysis and knowledge to a certain extent.
Would you think it's sometimes just that power dynamic that we just kind of started off with between a landlord and a renter, for instance, or a tenant, versus when it comes to the government or like the people within that, listening to the advice of someone like a massive, like a $1 billion company, going, you know what you're talking about. I want to, like, I'm going to follow your advice blindly, and now you're just stuck, and this is what happened, and they can't like back out of it without like apologizing nearly.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that absolutely it's who they listen to.
It's who they listen to.
Yeah, who they listen to and who they were meeting. And it does link back to the financial crash and the housing crash that we had in 2008.
Do you think the intentions were actually not malicious? We're not going to put like anyone under the bus here, or we could, whatever. But like, do you think the intention was?
I think personally, that personally on,
like,
their part,
like a personal gain from it.
I think, well, clearly we know now that
some
TDs who were voting as part of government were benefiting. They're multiple property owners. They are landlords. And I would put it as a combination of personal gain with their ideology, the way they see the world, and the people they mix with and the people they were listening to. And it was almost that they didn't see any, they couldn't see an alternative way of doing it. This is the only way we could do it. And I don't think they really considered about the future generations, about generation rent. They weren't thinking about what is this going to mean in 5 years or 10 years. They were thinking about just now, does this solve my immediate problem for me now? Does it seem like I'm doing the right thing? This is great. They bought into the, like I describe it as a form of capture. You know, their heads were captured. They were bought into, they were wooed by the investor funds who said, oh, we'll solve all your housing problems. Don't worry about it. Like Owen Murphy, the Minister for Housing at the time, was like saying, oh, co-living is like this boutique hotel type thing. And he bought into it.
Yeah.
He believed it. And
did he live in a boutique hotel?
I have no idea where he lived. Or
I'd love to know whether he was living in a
highly space. Highly unlikely. And if he was, he probably had the option of going back home or renting somewhere else.
Yeah. Always in trouble. There you go.
Yeah. But I do think that it's their... The part of the... How would you describe it? That kind of, those groups who are very powerful in society, who number one didn't want, you know, wanted rents, like those investor funds, they were really influential over the kind of those years, 2013, you know, up till still today. they have become really influential in Irish policy. And I think people listen to them. They have lobbyists. They're in there. They're the ones who have all the money. And the government at the time were like, oh, we've no money. We can't do anything. So we need you. And of course, not looking at our history. But they didn't want to. They didn't believe in the state, in government, in doing something different that would challenge the market or developers.
You're a social policy professor. What would your understanding be of that? Like, what are, so obviously you explained like the elements that are playing a part in this decision-making process. There you go. Take us off.
Yes.
We're getting heavy now.
We're getting heavy. It's getting warm.
We brought social policy in.
Yes. When you mentioned social policy, like, okay, no, get serious now. Okay.
What, like, could we go deeper into that? Like, what are the influence, like what's influencing these decisions? Why are certain decisions like so bad, yet they're still going through with them? Even if it's not housing related, like what's at play here?
Yeah, what's at play? It's a big question. There are lots of things influencing why governments make decisions and how they make decisions. And a lot of it, you know, when we look at, for example, a crisis like housing or even health, and we think, oh my God, like they hardly made decisions that, you know, they knew things would get worse. But in part, it's like they almost believe their own kind of hype or in a way, or believe their own, it's almost, I describe them as like lies they tell themselves. It's not lies or mistruths. They believe the stories they tell themselves. It's like,
so
you know,
is it like psychological and personal nearly?
I think there is. It's a belief thing. Yeah, I think is a belief thing. It's a way.
I will change.
I will change this and I will do it. And I'm listening to the people that I think are important, mm-hmm. be they investor funds, big developers, the banks. They're the ones who know.
Yes.
And I think there's a real also unwillingness to challenge power as well. And we know wealth has huge power. So there's an unwillingness, I think, to really, and we've seen, you know, inequality grow significantly. And, you know, we're seeing that you see the gap in the generations as well, not just across the classes. And I think that government has, in Ireland, been very unwilling, I think, to take decisions that would kind of move us really significantly towards more equality, for example, around economic equality.
Is there a belief in economic equality, though?
I don't think there is.
Yeah.
No, I think that they believe in equality in lots of ways, in, you know, in terms of gender equality and...
Yeah, that's the easy stuff, though.
Yeah, well, it isn't.
On paper, it's easy.
Yes, yeah. But in terms of, they don't believe in economic equality. They believe in what you call the meritocracy, mm-hmm. as in you work really hard and you get to where you are. And, you know, we hear it all the time about people who are homeless, that, you know, that's something they have done. And so there's a real lack of understanding and a prejudice, I think, towards people in poverty or towards people on average incomes. They believe in the hierarchical society.
Yeah, it's this, like,
the way
it is. Next time, just study to become a software engineer rather than a nurse.
Exactly, exactly.
And
it's
like, no, that is like, we're going to end up with a lot of coders at a point in time and artificial intelligence is going to like sweep right through.
Yeah.
And everyone's going to be like, where are the nurses?
Yeah.
In Australia, that's where they are.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah.
And the teachers will be in Dubai. Yeah.
Teachers in Dubai, nurses in Australia.
The nurses in Australia, exactly.
It's so weird, yeah.
Yeah, it is. And it's very sad. You know, it is very sad that, you know, we're putting so much investment in, and these are our families and our friends and communities.
They're raising our children. They're helping our staff.
And childcare workers is the other one. You know, childcare workers who are paid very, very poorly here. And, you know, how are they supposed to live? Mm-hmm. Special needs assistants who work with children with additional needs, you know, they're paid very poorly as well, not valued. There's a real lack of valuing of the people who care. And of course, often that's a gendered, you know, they're predominantly women as well. And there's a gendered inequality. And again, you know, element of patriarchy to that as well. But I think in terms of social policy, it is a real, it's like ideology. It's the how you view the world. And if you view the world as the state is only there kind of to really help where things go really bad, but it's not there as this kind of general kind of organization that helps people and provides health and housing and education on a really big universal basis. If a lot of our governments are, they're more free market, right wing. They view the world as the state is there, you know, just to kind of just be there just enough to help people. But, you know, in reality, you work by yourself and you do it and then you'll get on. And, you know, we shouldn't be doing things like housing on a general scale or, you know, if, and we see it healthcare. You know, people have access to private care if they can afford it. How many of the government ministers ever have to queue in a public hospital?
Yeah, never.
Never, or spend time in homelessness?
Oh, no. No, that's the thing, eh? And I think it's like probably even just volunteering. Are they actually talking to these people? Are they understanding? Are you, I don't know, I'd love to see a politician have a podcast with like general people just questioning them all the time.
Yeah.
And just being in touch. Yeah. Now, besides complaining all the time.
Yes.
You then went about talking about solutions. And you said gaffes for all. And this is like your vision and your plan. So I wanted to just chat to you about this. And like, if you could explain them into a little bit of detail. Obviously you have 10, I believe. Yes,
yeah,
10.
Yeah.
So let's go through them one by one.
Okay, great.
Make housing a human right. Hold a referendum to put the right to housing in the constitution. How do you see that happening?
So housing, I think, linking back to what we talked about earlier about housing being treated as a commodity and an investment rather than home, there's a very clear value and, framework or a way of thinking about housing and treating housing done by the United Nations and developed over decades and decades, which is this idea of the right to housing, that housing should be a human right, and which means that it's a basic need that people can't live without. And the many countries in Europe and around the world have a right to housing in their constitution. We don't. Okay. We have a right to private property.
Oh.
Which is what I talked about earlier. Landlords say, you know, this is my property, and a tenant has no right to their home.
Yeah.
Because that property is, the right is about the ownership of that property. Mm. Now, there is a thing in the constitution where it says that that private property right can be delimited in terms of for social justice and the common good, but that has never really worked in terms of home and housing. And so I think that we need a referendum because we've seen huge change. Excuse me, been brought about through the marriage equality referendum, through the repeal referendum, huge social change in Ireland, real positive progressive change been brought about through referendums, through the whole process of people discussing it, debating it, arguing for it, campaigning,
yes,
all that. And I think that that process would, we could have like a whole conversation about how we understand housing and hopefully in that shift to this new way of viewing housing. And the opinion polls show that a majority of people support it.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly young people, unsurprisingly. And what's hopeful is that actually the government did a good thing. They set up a thing called a housing commission last year to look at a referendum, and we're hoping that they will recommend a right to housing referendum hopefully this year. So I'm very hopeful about that.
I like that. I never thought about the start of a referendum.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds really exciting actually.
Yeah.
Go on. We'll create a jingle for it or something on TikTok.
Very good.
Sorry, I don't mean to be taking the piss here.
No, take the piss away. No, take the piss is important because if we're going to win a referendum about a right to housing, there's going to have to be lots of taking the piss and, you know, making whatever, jingles and jokes and all sorts to connect with people and get people interested and engaged. Because my big worry would be the government says, yeah, okay, let's have a referendum about the right to housing. And then we can't engage people and they don't come out and the landlords come out.
There was a massive protest though, wasn't there? Like a few months ago, right?
Yeah, there was a big protest. Yeah, the Raise the Roof. There was thousands of people there and it was really good around housing. And I would be very hopeful, but it's not automatic that if you have a referendum that it wins.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so jingles are really important to get people to think about the right to housing and
Irish people vote. Wouldn't come back from Canada to vote, but if there's a housing referendum happening, I know the flights would increase.
Like, I would hope so. Absolutely. And in terms of climate, the boats as well.
Yeah, there you go. ferries from London.
Yeah.
A state guaranteed delivery of a sufficient supply of lifetime secure, affordable, decent quality green homes. I like the idea of green homes for all using public land for 100% actually affordable housing.
Yes. Yeah, so this is one of the big kind of proposals that I have and solutions. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier there about the market and the market not working to provide sufficient housing. So I think the state needs to do it. Now, the state, it's not, and I talk about this later on in the solutions, it's not like the state goes out and builds all these houses. It's like the state supports local authorities, local councils. There are things called housing associations, which are not-for-profit housing organizations, community organizations, cooperatives, individuals, to be able to build their own homes, to build homes, you know, using public land, so and giving them funding and finance. And having, I think we should have a public building company, I think, just like we have public hospitals and public schools that guarantee people of education and housing. Why don't we have a public housing company where people are given decent jobs, not gig economy jobs, to build homes? And also I was even thinking, like, I had this idea, you know, constantly, you know, trying to get a plumber in the house to fix a shower, and it's really expensive and you can't get them. I'm like, why isn't that like... you know, you go to the GP, like, why, you know, or you go to the doctor, why don't we have like a public service of plumbers and people who, you know, are paid by the government through our taxes, and you're guaranteed you have your things done, and, you know, it could be relatively affordable price. People would still pay for it, but it wouldn't be anything, and you would be guaranteed in terms of contrast to what you have to pay now. But I was thinking about that, you know, this is seems not mad, like,
yeah, like
and green homes are really important, and I don't mean like all the homes are painted the same color green.
Okay. I was thinking the ones, I don't know if you've ever been to Greece, but there's like a bunch of like plant homes, like apartment buildings,
okay,
with like a shit ton of greenery on the sides.
Okay,
those ones.
All right, I've seen them. I think they were in Vienna where they had, it was public housing and built by the, I think it was housing associations, and it was this giant block of apartments. I think they said there was something like 1,000 apartments, but they were beautiful. They similarly had all plants coming down the sides. Yeah. It was just all green, and you looked at it, and it almost looked like,
yeah, like a cauliflower patch on the
roof. Something like that, or like a building that has been gone back to nature, or something like that. And
those ones,
they were beautiful, and I don't see why we can't have sustainable environmental homes done in that way, that people could have little patches of gardens on their terraces or within the community and within the thing. And that's the other thing about the market. The market doesn't build those things in. They go, right, I have this land. How many units can I squeeze onto it to get the maximum amount of money from this plot? They don't think, okay, people need community space. They need, you know, more and more green space. And how do we do that? You know, how do we ensure that? It's all about the bottom line. And, you know, I always think like the market is Donald Trump, right? He's a real estate developer.
Yeah.
These are the people who decide what do we invest in? What do we build? You know,
They don't look that nice in fairness. Like they look like ugly buildings in my opinion too.
Well, it just seems a bit mad to me that people with that mindset are the ones who decide the most basic thing we have of all, our home.
I know. Yeah. Fight the power. Like, give.
We're trying.
I'm sure you're enjoying this Wednesday night, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely. I am. Yeah. Like no, it's great. It's great. When I walked in and saw the sticky notes on the book and that they weren't just stuck in, you actually have notes on the sticky notes. I was like, no, that's worth putting some effort into.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Look, I'm not fresh out of college, but like I actually did feel like I was back in college for a little bit.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I love this stuff.
Okay.
I love this stuff. If lecturing didn't require a PhD or like being, I'm a master's, like I've got my master's degree, but like philosophy and sociology and all of that kind of stuff is like my favorite thing.
Yeah.
If I could get rid of the PhD stuff.
Yeah.
And just like write a book. I'll just transcribe on my podcast and be like, there you go, university. And I could just lecture all day. I would. I don't
could,
know.
You could do a PhD on your podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's possible.
I don't do a PhD on my podcast.
What did you do your master's in?
Digital marketing, would you believe?
Digital marketing.
Yeah. Very so good. I had European studies and philosophy.
Okay. Back,
so it was economics, politics, law.
Yeah.
And a little bit of like Descartes in there.
Yeah.
Like
very true. Good. Very yeah, good.
It was fun. But this kind of stuff, I always liked politics without. I always liked political science, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
do things happen?
Yeah.
Rather than what and all that. Like, yeah. I don't care much about, like, not, no, I care about voting and stuff. But, like, anyways, Malta is like an unfortunate space when it comes to like politics and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. No, it's yeah. great to be interested because it's so important that, you know, people are interested in this, and a lot of people get turned off when
they get turned off because it's so intimidating,
yeah.
which you understand because yeah. it's like then the likes of NAMA comes in and Cuckoo Funds and Vulture and you're like, what the fuck is happening? If you explain it like there's a bunch of lads that look like and feel like they're Donald Trump,
yeah,
that are saying this is how you should live, then you go, oh, okay, I get that. I don't like that. What can I do?
I had included that in the book, I think, at one point.
Yeah,
and then, I took it out, or the editors took it out. I can't remember which. And I think it was probably they were terrified of libel or something like that.
Did you fight the power in that moment in time or no?
I tried to remember. I think I had put so much work into writing it that my will was probably just defeated ultimately. And I was like, I just wanted published. I just wanted published.
How long did it take you to do this?
Well, it's in reality, it's a work of years
mm.
Of research. And I wrote a book in 2020, which was years as well. And that was a much more academic book.
Mm.
So this book was written probably in about a year, I would think. It took me maybe a year to, and then really going hard, writing was probably about 3 or 4 months, I would say. But the research was years.
You yeah. know?
And then thinking all the time about, because the key thing about this book was I was trying to write it in a way that ideally anybody could pick it up and read it. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to think of things. And I'm pity I probably should have pushed the Donald Trump one a bit more now that
don't
I think
worry,
about it.
Hire me as a consultant.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Yes, yes, yes.
I'm joking. Oh, please don't.
No. Forever the digital marketer.
Sales will just plummet. Be like, who wrote this? End homelessness. How the fuck will that happen, Rory?
So the great thing is we have a lovely example of how this can happen. Two examples. One was in Finland, which is a country that most people have heard of. And as I always make this joke, it's not really a joke, or just try to be a bit funny. I'm not very good at it. I say that because there's a certain thing about, you know, homelessness that it's people's fault. Right.
Yeah.
So, and we even hear from the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, and all that, that, you know, it's, and other people, it's, you know, it's their fault. It's something they've, you know, done, which is really, they won't say that explicitly, but they kind of, you know, when you read through what they're saying, they go, you know, what he actually said, the Taoiseach actually said very clearly, he said, oh, most homelessness is not caused by a lack of housing. Okay. So what is it caused by? Clearly he's saying things that happen to people or that they do. But of course, the primary reason someone is homeless is because it's not fucking home. They can't, you know, afford the rent, or they can't, yeah. you know, they can't basically stay in their home. They've been evicted. Yeah, people have addiction and they have breakups and they have shit happens to them. They get sick, but they shouldn't lose their home because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's often what happens. And so, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, like homelessness is always the last case scenario. You
don't yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You don't do a line and end up on the street.
Exactly. And there's lots of people addicted who are from very wealthy families who, surprise, surprise, aren't homeless. But the point I was making there was that it's gone completely out of my head because it's late on a Wednesday night. Well, relatively late. Not really for most people, but for me it is. It's been a long day. I'm trying to think now.
Finland?
Yeah, Finland. Very good. Well, you were listening. That's great.
Oh, of course I'm listening. I got sticky notes.
That's true. Yes. The sticky notes. Finland. Yes. So, and I was actually trying to make a joke. That was it. Finland was... So yeah, that's what I say. So Ireland, about people and homeless, okay?
Yes.
So you say, is it something about people in Ireland that they're really bad people. So therefore we have more homelessness because we're shitty people here who do bad things. So that's why we have a higher, sorry to explain. Finland has very little homelessness. Mm-hmm. There's hardly anybody who's homeless there.
Yeah.
We have thousands of people are homeless. So if you draw the conclusion of, you know, people are homeless because of something bad they've done, we obviously have lots of bad people in Ireland. That's the thing. In Finland, like, they're really nice, good people, so they don't become homeless. But of course, that's completely illogical.
Of course, yeah. It's not an attack on the nationality.
Exactly. But the point being, so they must do something different there. Mm. So what they do in Finland is that they, number one, they measure people who are at risk of housing. They don't just count who's homeless. They count who's at risk of becoming homelessness. So couch surfers, people who are, because that's often what happens. People, you know, might get evicted and they go stay with a friend for a while or a family member, and then that breaks down and they become homeless. So they measure those, and they also provide housing as their first response. So if someone is homeless, they provide them a home, basically. And they've got an agency, a company, a social enterprise, not for profit, that's sole purpose is building and buying homes and allocating them to people who are homeless. So that's all it does. And they have supported that. And as a government for about 10 years now or more, they have had the very clear policy aim to end homelessness and eliminate it. And they've put everything in it and they've believed in it. It's also, it's a right. It's a human right in Finland as well, housing. So they've shown it can be done. And of course, during COVID, what we talked about, homelessness, excuse me, fell in Ireland because we found places that people could go to. We had an eviction ban. We had a rent freeze. And people were supported out of homelessness into homes, and they were supported. And there's a thing called Housing First, which we're working on now in Ireland, which is good. We need to do a lot more of it, which basically provides people who are long-term homeless with a home, and they get supports as well. And they find they can stay in their home now as well. But of course, key is building more social and affordable housing, providing it, and then we will end homelessness, which okay. We can.
Perfect. I'm going to leave the rest of the five for people to like read your book. I want to end it as if this were a college essay, weirdly enough, with a critique. You were criticized, and I want to bring this up to you.
Okay.
There's this one quote. Rory will never be wrong because what he is proposing will never happen, and he has no regard to cost. Now, I wrote down this moment because like when I read that, like it took me aback.
Hmm.
And I wrote down my response. So like this is Debbie, not yours.
Yeah.
My response is that the cost here is the quality of life. So what I'm taking away from this conversation and from you is that the cost that people are criticizing you about is not the money, but it's the children that are at risk of homelessness. It's renters, it's people in their 20s that can't like relax. What is your response to that critique about you?
Very, very impressive, I have to say. Because that I saw that comment. I can't remember where it was. Was it on
off there?
Yeah. Was it on Twitter or something? I did see that. Or maybe it was I think I remember now where it was. Okay. A particular person, person heavily involved in the industry. I was struck by that point as well, and it did stop me. So very well picked up. And your analysis, I think, is absolutely right in terms of the cost. And because I think they were saying, he was saying that, oh, am I saying there should be just like an open checkbook for housing? And I kind of went, yeah, in the sense that these costs that we talk about, because that's the point. They say that, you know, oh, we can only build for, you know, it's not viable for us to build at €400,000 a home, right? And you're going, well, number one, it doesn't cost that to build. It's all your extra costs that you put in and profit. But the point is that if the state, if we wanted to as a society, we could say, right, we have, you know, €6 billion that's going into this rainy day fund. We could use that now and build homes and provide homes and renovate derelict ones and buy up derelict ones and renovate them. And we could massively increase the supply of housing. It would be a significant cost. Like that's a massive amount of money. And it does cost that. Housing is expensive. But I draw the analogy with healthcare. We don't say to people, now there are obviously some levels, but generally we don't say, for example, to cancer patients, sorry, you're not getting this drug. It does happen sometimes, but generally we don't say to cancer patients, these drugs are really expensive and we're not sure whether we can provide them to you or not because it's not really, we're not sure is it viable as a cost.
Yeah.
We don't say that.
Yeah, like your life is not worth more than someone else's.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Not worth more than the bottom line of us as an economy or some pharmaceutical company. We will pay whatever it takes that you have that drug. Now, we do know, and it's interesting, in the United States, for example, and at a certain level, it does happen here that some drugs are considered too expensive to give to patients, public patients. And so that's interesting when you think about it. But generally, we say we pay for and not just cancer care, but for medicine. We cover the costs irrespective of what it costs because we say, well, people should have access to healthcare. We need to think the same about housing. That irrespective of the cost, you can't look at it narrowly, as you have said, as a financial immediate cost. You have to look at the other costs that we don't include, the cost to children being traumatized and hundreds of thousands of children growing up with their families in insecure private rental housing, not being able to belong, not being able to see a future. You know, younger generations not seeing a future in this country. That's a cost when they emigrate and we lose all that energy, you know, engagement. And of course it suits the politicians because they're like, hey, all the protesters are gone out the door, so we don't
all
have
the
to
hippies
worry.
Out
yeah exactly yeah. And all the potential people who will vote against us, but
it's true though,
but it is true, there's yeah. Of course there's an element of truth to that, but that you're right to say the cost, you can't look at the cost as narrow, what is this financial cost right now. You have to look at the much broader society individual cost, and the cost then, the return that you get when people have a home and they contribute and they want to be part of society. And even I think in terms of mental health, and you know, there's all this bullshit all the time about the snowflake generation and about, you know, Gen Z quiet quitting and not wanting to engage. And I don't know, well, part of it is probably because they've seen you have your home or multiple properties. They have no prospect of having a home. They're paying really high rents. They don't know, are we going to have a future as a climate, as a people, as humanity? So it's probably fair enough that you're going, fuck this for a game of yeah. soldiers. And, you know, I'm not buying into your bullshit, you know, work my ass off to do what? To pay your generation your rent, to pay an investor fund the rent. So yeah. I think there's a real narrow understanding and view of economic cost. And if we looked at it much broader, we would see actually we should do whatever it takes to ensure people have a home, because at least with that, all the other things, then we can, you know, try and green homes as well. We can include people and include young people in a different type of society, you know, in a different one where we do value people as people and we value the planet, our individual home and our collective home.
Exactly. And I think with just the Gen Z, like being one anyways or whatever, it's like we were raised by a generation most of the time where it's like, if you work hard enough, if you put your head down, you're going to get that raise, you're going to get that home, blah, 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 blah. And then just release us onto the market. We're starting to get jobs. And it's like, lads, this isn't it, huh? Like it's not even just like a hard hitting, like welcome to real life sort of thing. But it's like we were told that real life was differently because, of course, like that's what previous generations went through. So now we're obviously experiencing something new where once we bring it up once, twice, three times, and nothing's gonna happen. Like if, and in fairness, we're also a very like, smart generation. We're not stupid. We've got so much at our hands, at our fingertips now. A little bit of research, we can understand that, yeah, like we do deserve better in certain situations. So now it's like a giant, like, fuck you. If you're not going to help me, I know that I can go elsewhere.
Yeah.
And and I think a massive problem is a lot of people are going, you're not going to find elsewhere.
Mm.
when in reality it is the, like, people are struggling, companies are struggling, they're not paying their workers, right? And then they're stuck, they can't fill that position in because people are leaving. And I think that's the one thing that we still haven't, like, that's the carrot on the stick that's dangling in front of our generation. It's the property.
Mm.
So I wanted to say, like, thank you for what you're doing. I think especially, obviously, people look up to you. There's an age difference as well. I look up to you. I'm sure, like, a lot of people do. I see people with your little book. Oh, I was roaming around all of Dublin and everyone was, like, pointing out to it. So, that's like, nice, it's a little thing. Look, you're a bestseller for a reason. So, like, I wanted to say thank you for that. Like, from me and the 18 to 34-year-olds that are listening to this. So thank you, Rory, for joining me. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate that. And it's good to hear, because that is what motivated me to write it, and to write it in a way. I wanted to fire your generation up.
Yeah.
I wanted to, because I care, and I care about your generation and my children coming up behind you. I saw what was going on and I could see this, and I was really, and also it connects back with history in Ireland. Like, I've read about waves of emigration where people have had to leave Ireland because governments have fucked things up and they don't care about the youth and young people, and they're willing to sacrifice them. And there's something in our history of an ability of one group of people to sacrifice essentially another to keep the status quo. And I wanted to try change that, and hopefully it will inspire and does inspire your generation to not accept this situation and protest and get active and demand and do something different.
Exactly. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And thank you everyone for listening/watching. I hope you enjoyed it. Bye-bye. If you enjoyed my chat with Rory Horan, please share it. It's a really important topic. We're all talking about the housing crisis right now. If you wouldn't mind sharing it, if you don't want to share it, if you're too shy, fair enough, just send me a message. Let me know what you think. And remember, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button, hit the follow button. The bigger the platform is, the bigger the guests. And I want to bring more people on like Rory Horan. Thank you so much to Rory for joining me, and have a good one. Bye.